The following program is pre-recorded. That was the voice of the late Walter Haught. He was a public information officer in Roswell at the time of the Roswell crash. He was telling about the ET body that he saw in the hangar. Listen closely. This is Edgar Mitchell, astronaut.
Yes, there have been ET visitation. There have been crashed craft. There have been material and bodies recovered.
Welcome to Jerry Pippin's UFO Show, and we are going to be dealing once again with the UFO crash phenomena. Lots of UFO crashes in United States history, but also around the world. First off, let's talk about an incident in Wales known as the Roswell of the UK. This is Jerry Pippin, and welcome to our UFO Show. We're on location this week in Las Vegas, Nevada. Philip Mantle is involved with UFO Matrix, a great magazine, a very slick little ditty that comes out on a regular basis out of the UK. Has an interesting story this week, and it's about a January 1974 incident that's known in some quarters as the Welsh Roswell incident. It took place in the Berwyn Mountains of northern Wales. Many claim that on the night of January 23rd, 1974, a UFO landed and a strong military presence kept this largely from the public eye. Local villagers nearby were awakened by a loud bang and rumbling. The rumbling was from the mountains, and there were strange lights being observed. A local nurse by the name of Pat Evans even went to the site to see if she could offer her services. UFO proponents have long argued that a UFO did land that night, and the UK authorities made it a cover-up. Skeptics argue that it was all a mistake, and that a small earth tremor and natural astronomical objects accounted for what the observations were made by the residents at night. Now, in the newsstand magazine UFO Matrix, these two sides of the argument come together. Actually, I think this is the first time anyone's attempted to get all sides together on this issue. So our hats off to UFO Matrix magazine about this. Welsh UFO researcher Scott Felton has put forward his evidence for why he is convinced that it was indeed a UFO that landed that night, and why, really, it can't be explained away. On the opposite side is UFO skeptic and author Andy Roberts, known in the UK as a skeptic, and basically uses the old adage, why would anybody believe a story like that argument? So what's new? So I guess the question is, did a UFO land at the Berwyn Mountains in January of 1974 in Wales? Is it indeed the Wales Roswell? Or is it all a huge mistake? And what was the loud boom? Was it nothing more than a small earth tremor? I really would recommend you, if you're in the UK, especially, to get the UFO Matrix magazine. And it's available worldwide. You can contact them by their website or call Amanda Owens or email her, either way. And we will be putting that email address on our UFO Shows to Go page later tonight. Let's get on with the show. In Las Vegas, we'll be talking to several people who know about UFO crashes, who have investigated them, who have strong opinions, people like Bill Hamilton. And our first guest, who was a lieutenant colonel for the United States Air Force, his name is Ron Blackburn, and I think what you will find that he has to say is indeed very, very interesting. That's coming up next. from Las Vegas. Tales of High Strangeness, Jerry Pippin's Parazone. Check out our stories of the horrific, the interesting, the spiritual on the paranormal pages of jerrypippin.com. Let's get right to the show and let's discuss black operations. Our guest is Ron Blackburn.
You're a retired Lieutenant Colonel in the Air Force. You had some interesting jobs when you were in the Air Force.
Well, I had a number of assignments. I spent actually 13 years in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I started out at the Air Force Special Weapons Center and worked for the Air Force Weapons Lab two times after that. Worked on advanced EMP projects.
Well, you had several patents and inventions, and the rumor in the scuttlebutt is that you may have used some UFO technology with this. Is there anything true to that?
Well...
What can you say and what you can't say?
well, I can be pretty open about that. I was doing some UFO investigations, and it occurred to me that people were not reporting sonic booms from UFO flights. So I looked at that and reverse engineered the process to mitigate or eliminate sonic booms, at least up to Mach 3 or 4. So I thought that'd be a great idea.
So that can actually be, you can actually get rid of them, huh?
Absolutely, get rid of it. The sonic boom completely dissipates, then would allow flights over populated areas without the hazard of the boom.
Yeah, without knocking everybody's windows out.
Absolutely. I probably made a mistake when I found the patent in the United States Patent Office. I included some sketches. They'd like to know how your idea originated, and I actually drew a few sketches of flying saucers and the method that the saucer uses to mitigate the sonic boom. And I used the same technology. Basically, it's high-powered microwave from the leading edge of the disc to preheat the air.
So, now, when you make a statement like that, I've got to follow that up. Have you actually seen a flying saucer, UFO?
My analysis was from video clips.
Okay.
From various and a few hundred different film clips.
See, I had visions that maybe you could tell me that you've been on a saucer and flying around.
Well, I haven't, but
yeah.
Willing, able, and ready.
But that's how they do it with microwave.
Well, that's one way, and that's the way I believe it's done. It's around a half degree beam width, and it goes out a few thousand feet in front, and the air is preheated to several thousand degrees. It's 60 gigahertz, that's the resonant frequency of oxygen, so it works throughout the whole atmosphere.
Now, what are other kind of inventions? All of them are aerial type convention, right? I mean, your inventions deal with aerospace products or what? I mean, you have several patents.
Several patents. I can not talk about one where I was...
Well, that's the one I'd like to talk about.
No, I understand. I submitted the idea for a cloaking device, and people are probably well familiar with a number of photographs people have at the beach, the zoo. They come home and they photograph the family scene, and there's a UFO in there, and that's very mysterious because people didn't remember seeing it or didn't see it. Well, I reverse engineered that, so I determined how the saucer cloaked itself. So I thought I'd be a clever chap and apply for a patent.
So I assume that would probably do something with shifting the light rays or vibes or the spectrum.
Well, I went into it. And it's a sound engineering device. I submitted the patent office, and they come back very curious. They said this idea is not patentable. which deflated my ego. But then he went on and said, but Ron, you understand that this whole idea is foreign export controlled.
Wow.
Wait a minute. It's not patentable. It's not classified, but it's foreign export controlled. And I said, yep.
So what were they trying to tell you there?
Well, I don't know. I'm very frustrated along that line. But I guess I can disclose the idea to any documented U.S. citizen, under heavy non-disclosure. And I'm certainly willing to do that to certain people.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we talk about your Air Force career, you mentioned, and it kind of just went right by. You did UFO investigations, or
that was more of an avocation. My real assignment was electromagnetic pulse. That was sort of exotic area. South of the runway in Albuquerque, there's a lot of exotic structures, and I was a principal design team and manager to build those back in the early 70s.
Yeah, I mean, you immediately, when you mentioned where you were stationed for a huge part of your career, my ears perk up, not far from Sandia Base, not far from Los Alamos.
Well, I did have a neighbor. His name was Dick Caudill. And he was the state neutral UFO network director, and we had a social relationship in our family. He sort of sparked my interest in UFOs at that particular time. And one day in the paper, he announced 2 weeks in advance that two saucers were going to fly into the air base, back to the air base, one evening. That was pretty startling, but the article went on to say three were going to fly out a couple hours later.
And this was in a regular newspaper?
A regular Albuquerque Tribune essay.
The Albuquerque, right.
And would you believe it? The time came and went, and that's exactly what happened. Two flew in, it was observed, and a few hours later, three saucers flew out.
Did you actually see them?
No, I didn't. I sort of didn't believe, this is too much to believe. I didn't stay up to observe it,
Yeah, did he give you a time and when this was going to happen?
I'm not sure he knew the time. He said within the next couple of weeks that was going to happen.
Well, there have been all kinds of stories about UFOs on the runways there at, what is that, Kirtland?
Kirtland Air Force Base, and there's actually... Yeah. When I was signed there in the early 60s, there were three air bases. There was Kirtland Air Force Base, which was Air Force, Sandia Base, which was Army. Then there was a Manzano munition storage area, which is sort of south of the runway with a large number of fences.
I always hear about a lot of underground activity at Sandia, even. I mean, like they have a lot of things underground. Do you know if that's true or not?
I only know about the Manzano base, okay. The munition storage. I did have a tour of that. It's a highly secure area, but I mean in the sense of physical security. But
and I take it you probably worked a large part of your career in unison or in conjunction, liaison with aerospace industry companies and corporations, then probably, right? I mean,
we were...
probably wasn't all just the Air Force people you were dealing with.
Well, a lot of contractors do a lot of the technical work, and when you move up to lieutenant colonel, you're a management rank.
Yes.
And, you really don't have much time to work. You're managing the subcontracts. Mm-hmm. One time I had 30 contracts I was managing.
30, wow. Okay. You have any connection with Area 51?
That's probably off the book.
Okay. I just thought I'd throw that in, right?
Yeah, right.
You never know. Sometimes you get an answer.
Correct, yeah. Well, you know.
Can you tell me, you made these patents, so you obviously don't feel that there's going to be a huge revelation here, so you have a right to make these patents as well as anybody else.
Well, I believe that it's technology, and I submitted the patent through the process, and if the government didn't want that disclosed, they certainly could have contacted me, but it's actually published in the Patent Gazette, the complete set of details. So it's sort of interesting about the foreign non-disclosure to foreign nationals.
What do you think is really going on with all that you can say? I know you know a lot, or suspect a lot, and have reasons to suspect it, but, you know, you come to these UFO conferences, you're interested in the subject. What's happening here? Is there an agreement going on between you guys and the ETs?
Well, gosh, you know, everybody would like to know the answer to that question. My reason to come is to stimulate creativity and ideas. And, you know, there's rumors by other folks here that a lot of inventions were back engineered, you know, Velcro, transistors, fiber optics. So I come in here looking for ideas, and like the one I talked about with the sonic boom.
Uh-huh.
It just sort of pops in your mind, you know. Gee, this is how they do it, you know.
Yeah. So you're basically here because you're interested in the subject, and second of all, it gives you an idea on how to develop something with our technology.
Right. And if the aliens are all this is real, that's great. If it's not, you know, that's okay. But from the creativity process, if we can build advanced technology inventions, you know, that's well worth the...
You ever been around evidence of an ET crash or something connected to that? This is a crash retrieval conference.
Well, I've had discussions with...
crying again.
Couple folks, and one claimed that... it was necessary to do radiation analysis of the Roswell crashed hardware prior to being shipped out to various locations. I think the concern was it might be radioactive. So this particular individual analyzed every piece of hardware equipment that come through prior to being dispatched to other locations.
Any of it radioactive?
He said it was not.
Okay.
But there's real concern that it might be, so that's how he got involved.
Uh-huh.
And another person actually claimed to handle the bodies of the Roswell crash.
And was that story basically what we've always heard about the small bodies and shard and et cetera? Or?
Exactly. This gentleman has since transitioned. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't be even discussing it, but he talked about the bodies in the yellow bags, and it seemed to be pretty hazardous, you know, from the bio aspect, so he was very careful about that. And he was 80-some years old and incredibly concerned about security, which sort of surprising his age.
In other words, he just because he was getting old, he still honored it. All of the threats.
Well, that was interesting. On my parting visit, I made up a story as I walked out the door, just on the spur of the moment, and I said, well, I'm understanding that the Congress and the President may be thinking about granting immunity to all these folks that where we can always go back and get the real story. And he made a stunning comment. He said, the President edict would not be near enough.
Hmm. So draw from that what, a higher power?
I don't know. He, you know, that was the end of the talk, you know. And
where was he when he saw these bodies, did you say?
He was at Loveless Clinic in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
So here again, this New Mexico connection has been since the history of the UFO phenomenon.
Right? Oh, absolutely. Right, yeah.
And
the thread keeps running through Albuquerque and Kirtland. And,
yeah, it does, doesn't it? And, hey, it's a pleasure meeting you. And, you know, I hope we can talk more candidly about some of this stuff pretty soon.
Well, as I get older, maybe I'll forget.
I'll look you up when you're 80-something and see if you...
Okay, yeah, maybe I have more revelations.
Thank you very much.
It's been very...
Investigator and author Anthony Sanchez.
The name of the book is UFO Highway. I found that although I was diverging into multiple areas of UFO research, I kept finding myself back on the same road. And I found that all these different aspects of ufology were interconnected. So I decided to call the book UFO Highway.
This is the book that could not wait for a regular publisher. It had to be released now. The information is so sensitive, so shocking, so well researched. Colonel X comes from the dark shadows for the light of truth. The inside story of Area 51 and the challenging truth about extraterrestrials. The e-book of the century, now on sale. For information and to order, go to UFOHighway.com. The reason we're presenting these shows from Las Vegas is very simple. The fact is that if you talk about crash retrievals, you cannot not talk about the Wood family. Robert Wood, the father, and in addition to that, the son, Ryan S. Wood, who's been posting things about crash retrievals, written a great book about it, and has had several conferences in Las Vegas about it, in which we did some broadcasts. Not only, though, does the retrieval conference deal with current crashes, it also deals with technology. And I think you'll find this interview very, very interesting. We have a very interesting man here, Michael Surratt. You've got a DVD out right now, and this DVD is called U.S. Air Force Secrets Revealed. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jerry, for having me on.
And I've heard lots of good comments about what you talked about here. You get into these Air Force secrets pretty heavily.
That's correct.
Give the listeners a little bit of background. What do you do there in Chicago?
I'm an aerospace draftsman in Chicago. We do a lot of STC work for foreign and domestic airlines, including Boeing 747, Airbus A320. We also do in-flight entertainment and cable routing for in-flight entertainment.
So you're not a stranger to the aeronautics industry at all?
No, sir.
And how'd you get into these Air Force secrets? Tell me a little bit about that. How do you know about these things?
I've always been interested in unusual aircraft, not the type of aircraft that you would generally see at your local air show. So when you would see a P-51 or a B-17, I thought that was interesting, but I knew that there was a secret behind the secret, and I made it my mandate to follow up on these leads, interviewing pilots, engineers, aerospace personnel, military personnel who've worked on these programs and have actually test flown these classified aircraft, and that's some of the material that's covered in my DVD.
Now, you know, when we talk about this DVD, you get some pretty interesting things on there. How'd you come up with this video?
Well, after interviewing a number of pilots, of course, some of the engineers who work for Lockheed Skunk Works, they were hesitant at first to divulge some of the secrets, but I kept at it, and they did provide some 3D drawings, and from that point, I cleaned them up in AutoCAD, and you see the result.
Now, before we came on the air, and you mentioned this in your presentation, there are lots of reasons why these things are still secret,
right.
But we're going to get into the technology of this here in a moment. And you were telling me you could probably fly with this new technology as a commercial airline from Chicago to L.A. probably for $11.
Well, I think that's...
What are we talking about?
Well, what we're talking about, Jerry, is if we examine the Northrop B-2 stealth bomber, of which the per-cost procurement for the B-2 is $2.2 billion per aircraft. That's more than its own weight in gold. So I'm posing the question... Is there more to the B-2, Jerry, than meets the eye? I believe there really is.
Well, you would think the government wouldn't hand out $3.2 billion per copy if it didn't have something there. I've always wondered and marveled at that price.
Absolutely. And we do have some evidence from Aviation Week Space Technology, March 9th, 1992. A number of Northrop engineers came forward, and they stated that there's a number of classified technologies currently in use on the B-2. For example, they mentioned that the B-2 electrically charges the leading edge of the wing to reduce the radar cross-section. It also electrically charges the exhaust gases to reduce the infrared signature. Now, what's interesting, when that happens, via a 1968 report from Northrop, they found out that when you electrically charge the leading edge of the wing, there's a resultant drag coefficient up to 60%, thereby a fuel savings up to 60%, which would be monumentally important to the airline industry.
And you don't see any evidence that the airline industry is getting any of this technology, do you?
Absolutely not, and that's why the engineers that are mentioned in this article were furious that it wasn't trickling down to the commercial airline industry.
Tell me a little bit about some of the things that you talked about here. What this technology, what is it exactly? Does it use regular fuel, or is it a how's it powered?
What we're dealing with here, Jerry, are three distinct levels.
Okay.
We're talking about black programs. That's any program that has less than 5% congressional oversight. The second program is called a deep black program, and the third and final category is what we've termed a USAP, or unacknowledged special access program. And if you work in one of those projects and the president asks you for specific details regarding that program, your mandatory replies to be, "Mr. President, no such project exists."
So they're lying to the chief executive of the country.
Absolutely.
And who gives them the authority to do this?
Well, it's beyond the government officials, because this is not kept within the government. It's not kept, or it's not a part of the elected official governments of this republic. This is a privatized defense contractor, aerospace-type corporation, a conglomerate of different military-industrial complex leaders such as Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, SAIC out of San Diego, that's Science Applications International Corporation. That's just a few examples of some of the engineering programs.
So they basically bypass the right to know and all of that because they're private.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And that basically is how they get by all of this.
Without a doubt.
I've kind of felt that way about a lot of the black operations and the deep black operations.
Mm-hmm. Well, funny you mentioned deep black operations, because there's a document that I have in front of me here called Department of Defense for Fiscal Year 1994. This is the budgetary report that's handed out to Congress every January. It has the subheading RDT&E Programs R1. That stands for Research, Development, Tests, and Evaluations, R1. And anyone can get a copy of this at the Library of Congress, which is just in back of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. And when you start going through this rather lengthy and boring document, they talk about program funding for F-16 operations, countermeasures, electronic countermeasures. But then as you get near the end of this document, these programs start falling off the radar screen. For example, Forest Green, Constant Help. They don't tell you what the program is. They don't tell you how much was spent on the program. So the bottom line is you take the total amount from the knowns, and what you're left with are the unknown or black budget programs.
So you basically based most of your research on filling in the holes of what they make public.
Well, yes, we have to extrapolate the data from the fragments that we've been given. Correct.
And when we talk about, where did this technology come from?
Well, a lot of this technology comes from spending four decades on classified black budget programs, anyone between $51 to $400 billion per year with no congressional oversight. Now, when you spend $400 billion per year, you're going to get something out of that.
And this is probably a huge profit center for all these corporations you named, and yet nobody knows about it.
Well, in fact, that's true in some of the cases. For example, we'll review one aircraft right here. It might be difficult for listeners to imagine this, but if you can use your mind's eye, we have a photograph of the Boeing Phantom Works Bird of Prey that was declassified under the current Bush administration back in 2002. This was the stealth prototype demonstrator that actually turned into an unmanned combat aerial vehicle. This was the manned version of this aircraft. It was the first aircraft to use a side-scanning radar for the interior section of the aircraft, and it also cost $67 million per aircraft.
This picture you have is basically a flying saucer-looking type craft with huge stilts or legs, or what is that?
Well, this is the landing gear here.
Okay.
And we can have another view of the side. You'll see it looks a little bit more conventional, but this is 47 feet in length, a 23-foot wingspan. 38 test flights were made between 1992 and 1999 at the remote test site in Nevada.
Is it your position, Mike, that all of this sightings reports we see over and over and the things we get or all black operations?
It's my belief that 95% of what we see flying in the skies is U.S.-built military hardware that's being mistaken for alien vehicles. However, the remaining 5% represents the core of this phenomenon.
Okay, so we're going to have to go to a break here, and then we'll come back. I want to talk to you a little bit about what is this picture that you're showing now.
This picture is the A-12 Avenger II. It was a joint McDonnell Douglas General Dynamics program used as
Tell our audience is listening exactly what that looks like.
It looks like a flying Dorito. It was actually called the flying Dorito.
So we spent billions on this technology.
Right.
And we're not sharing it with anybody.
Well, not only are we not sharing it with anybody, we are not even sharing it with ourselves, because in this particular program that was designed to replace the A-6 Intruder carrier-based aircraft, we spent $5 billion of research and development funding on this program for fiscal year 1990. 620 aircraft were procured for the A-12 Avenger II. But 1 year later, in 1991, our good friend Dick Cheney canceled the program at the cost of $5 billion to taxpayers, and now, Jerry, we have nothing to show for it.
This is Jerry Pippen. We're at the Tuscany, and we're broadcasting from the UFO conference, Crash Retrieval Conference. Michael Surratt, that's classified as what you called the name of your speech, and your DVD is... I want to ask you about this craft on top of your picture of your DVD here in a minute. The U.S. Air Force... Secrets Revealed DVD, and the things that we've been talking about, they're on the DVD. What is this object at the top? It looks like kind of like a Shrine Auditorium or something.
Well, Jerry, I'm glad you asked that question, because everything that I do, Jerry, is fully illustrated. I don't enjoy looking at texts and bar charts and pie charts and grayscales. Whenever you hear something, you have a visual aid to back it up, and you've got the documentation that backs it up, too. So we've got some really good, interesting points here. Now, you're referring to the craft that was at Norton Air Force Base on November the 12th of 1988. There was a covert dog and pony show / exhibition or exhibit inside the big hangar at Norton Air Force Base.
So, in other words, the covert dog and pony show, the movers and shakers in the industry and the government itself
exactly.
had a right to know.
Exactly.
And what did they see?
Well, high-level government officials, including military brass, were present. We know that Congressman George E. Brown Jr. was present. We know that Senator Alan Cranston was present. And inside this hangar, which was designed to garner support for black programs, were a number of classified aircraft, one of which was an aircraft that looked like a flattened football diamond-shaped craft. This comes from Aviation Week Space Technology, December 24th, 1990. The entire exterior of the craft was composed of heat-ablative thermal-resistant space shuttle tiles that were completely scorched black. Approximately 100 feet in length, 65 feet wide, it had two air intakes on both sides of the center line. It was a completely unmanned aerial vehicle, tricycle landing gear, control surfaces along the leading and trailing edge of the aircraft, Jerry.
What did they cost us?
Well, we don't know exactly how much this one cost, but we do know some of the performance specifications. Now, how this thing actually worked, and this was unmanned. Once the aircraft, via four turbojet engines, which were buried into the fuselage of this aircraft, once it got going up to about Mach 3, the entire leading edge of this aircraft started glowing red hot. At that point, the NACA air intakes would slam shut, making it very aerodynamically efficient. Once that happens, they started introducing a modified liquid methane fuel with a boron-based additive directly into this superheated shockwave, and as soon as that happens, it would immediately expand and combust and compress between the superheated shockwave and the tapered afterbody of this aircraft, pushing it across the sky at about 12,000 miles an hour.
12,000.
That's correct, Jerry.
And we have those.
We have those.
At least one.
They were built under the Reagan administration Star Wars program.
So they're not new.
No, they're not new, Jerry.
We had something that for two decades almost that goes 12,000 miles per hour.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It also had 121 nuclear launch tubes that were positioned on the lower forward section of this aircraft, each containing a 1/10 megaton warhead that could be launched in a 1/10 of a second, Jerry.
Are we still flying that?
We believe a much more advanced version of this aircraft is now flying. Yes, absolutely.
With nuclear weapon warheads and...
A new version that completely does away with the sonic footprint of this aircraft. You no longer can see or hear this thing coming. And this is one reason why when the Soviet generals, who got a sneak peek before the American congressional members saw this display, when they saw the aircraft that we had in this hangar, they threw up their hands and they said, we're done. We cannot compete with American air power. A few years later, the Soviet Union no longer exists and we won the Cold War, Jerry.
Now, what are we going to use? Why aren't we using the, you know, it appears to me like the places in Iraq and Afghanistan, are we using weapons like this and not telling anybody? Or
Jerry, these aircraft represent America's ace in the hole. I don't know for sure if they would really be rolling these out for instances like that. This is reserved for something completely different.
Wow. That's just amazing. What else do we have that we're not sharing? Now, you're in a commercial industry,
right?
The airline industry. It seems to me they ought to be upset about it, but I guess they're all going along to get along.
That's true. The other aircraft that was in this hangar was an aircraft that we're calling the Super Stall. Approximately 25-foot length. It had conventional tail arrangement in the aft end of the aircraft. There was a conventional F-16 heads-up display in the forward crew compartment that had a crew of one. They also had two miniature turbofan engines that tapered back to an extremely interesting platypus exhaust port here, and also conventional outrigger wheel arrangement. But, Jerry, the most interesting portion of this aircraft was the Inconel Venetian blind wings that the pilot had the capability of vectoring from zero angle of attack up to 45 degrees angle of attack, allowing for vertical takeoff.
So it would literally go straight up if you needed.
Go straight up. And the forward portion of this aircraft had a 30-millimeter Gatling gun that was taken directly off the Republic A-10 Warthog tank buster. So it was a Marine close support attack aircraft.
So basically, when we're talking about these type of Air Force secrets, we're talking about weapons that really sound like they're out of some science fiction movie.
I couldn't agree more, Jerry. You're absolutely correct.
But the point, Michael, is why aren't we using these? Why are we keeping them top secret?
Well, we're keeping them top secret, Jerry, because in point of fact, we have two space programs now in the Republic of the United States. One space program in the form of a NASA public relations space program, the other in the form of a much more privatized defense contractor space program with no congressional oversight.
And it seems to me that NASA is guilty of negligent homicide, if nothing else, using this outdated equipment. They lost some astronauts.
I would agree to a certain extent. However, NASA has no need to know about these programs. They're so low on the totem pole scale of important things that they're not even clued in on some of these programs.
We could go for hours, Michael. Thanks very much for being on. And the DVD is available
at
Amazon.
Basically, it's available
on your website.
I don't even have a website.
Okay,
but
how are we going to get this out?
Okay, how you would get it out is by calling 815-814-2145. Speak to me via email, leave me a message, and we can go over specific details about how to get this DVD.
And, hey, we'll talk to you about it. We have a merchandising shopping channel. We might even sell it for you.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much.
Excellent.
We mentioned Robert Wood a little earlier in the program, the father of Ryan S. Wood, the promoter of the crash retrieval conferences, and perhaps they'll start those again. Those were really one of my favorite conferences, if not the favorite conference. Always interested in this subject. Always have been. Hope you are, too. Let's continue the show. We found Robert Wood, the father, at one of the conferences. This goes all the way back to 2005. But basically 2005. But basically, I think you'll find it very interesting. Robert Wood. The man behind the Crash Retrieval Conference. Well, I mean, his son does most of the work, but if Robert hadn't done his work earlier, there'd be no son. That's another story. Okay, let's play that.
Dr. Robert Wood, it's a pleasure having you on the air.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, you know, you've got an interesting subject here at the conference, reverse engineering. But you deal in quite a few UFO subject matter topics over the years. I've seen your lectures.
Right. I first started on this subject in the late 60s when my boss actually asked me to predict how the Air Force should get to orbit and back 10 years hence. And so I said, well, just for a joke, I said, well, why don't you tell them how the alleged UFOs do it? And he said, well, why don't you look that up? And so I read my first UFO book on company time.
Well, it's a good way to start. Get paid for it. And you were hooked, I take it.
Right. After I read 50 books, I concluded, hey, there's a problem here. I wound up knowing Jim McDonald very well, actually. Whenever he came to town, I'd take him around and get him to his next speaking.
We've done shows on Professor McDonald, and he was quite the interesting personality.
He kept extremely good records.
And what are you interested in? I mean, you're still active, you know what? You just got married like 4 or 5 years ago, or less than that?
5 years ago, June.
I've been checking up on you here.
when I retired in 1993 from my 43 years at McDonnell Douglas, I was poised, wanting to get into what I knew was going to be the most important scientific discovery of our mankind, and that was to try to figure out how they work. And so I wound up starting because Stan Friedman, who's well known in this community, pointed the way to me to a question document that had been leaked, and this turned out to be the Special Operations Manual, which I authenticated.
And so there's no doubt in your mind that that is authentic material.
Oh, there's absolutely no question. But what is a document that was published by a printing press in 1954? Mm-hmm. Now, whether or not the content was created by some psychological warfare operation of the CIA or not, that's always a question. But the arguments for doing that are non-existent. So the most likely case, I'd say 99 chances out of 100, is that it is exactly what it seems to be, an instruction manual to the troops in the field as to how to recover crash flying saucers.
How many, I know your son wrote, Ryan, he wrote a book that said 73, 74 crashes?
Well, he's got a new book out called Magic Eyes Only, which describes to varying extents the details of 74 crashes.
74, that many.
Yeah.
What stands out in your mind over the years? Were there survivors of any of these crashes? I'm sure there were.
The thing that impresses me about that fact that there are 74 crashes identified in the book is that that's a larger number than Lynn Springfield gave me when I asked him a question like in 1990. And he said, you know, Lynn, in your opinion, what's the number of crashes you'd say are clearly authentic? And he said, well, maybe 10. But he was way low.
Obviously, from 74 down to 10.
No, Lynn Springfield was the guy who kind of became a lightning rod for people who wanted to tell about their crash observations. And so it was really his stimulation that caused me to get into the issue of what were the broad spectrum of crash reports. And that was a paper at the last conference, really, that Ryan has scooped up and converted into a book.
Now when we talk about the research aspect of this, how difficult, I mean, it seems there's obviously a lot of legwork involved. Are there a lot of roadblocks? I guess there are. People leading you down the wrong path when you start looking at these things, or I'm very curious about how this really works, how you develop a story, you know.
The way it works is people come to a meeting like this, where we are now at the third UFO Crash Retrieval Conference, and they try to get you aside and say, you know, you're not going to believe this, but I've got a story to tell you. And so they give you the card, and you can follow up. These days, of course, you'd follow up with email and a telephone call, but you'd like to get a written record from them as what they really saw or claim they saw. usually these don't go beyond the I saw this thing at a particular time, because you try to probe and find out, well, what is the level of detail that they saw? And if it's a light in the sky, and if there's no documentation, I personally don't get interested. Somebody else follows that up as far as I'm concerned. If there's documentation, if there's something in writing, that's my specialty, authenticating question documents. And if it's a crash, then Ryan has got an interest because he wants to keep this subject of crash retrievals current.
Now, over the years, what has changed from your own personal viewpoint about what we're dealing with today?
That's an excellent question, Jerry, because it has changed over the years. If you imagine what we were dealing with mostly in the 60s and 70s, we're talking largely about close observations, an occasional photograph by a still camera that showed anomalous shapes, and even in some cases comparison of shapes that were absolutely identical, separated in some years. Once in a while you get somebody who would say, well, I think I may have been abducted. And then, of course, there was that famous case of the Betty and Barney Hill abduction. But since then, what's been happening is that a lot more abductions. Through 1985 to, say, 2000, lots of abductions and abduction books and abduction stories. And interestingly enough, since then, that seems to have dropped off a little bit in terms of the number of people who are...
Not as many abducted reports now, huh?
Yeah, so there's actually trends. And if your question is very good, because it's caused me to think a little bit. If I were to try to describe, you know, decade by decade, what was the main focus, I'd say in the 40s it was lights in the sky. This is what the media was talking about, okay, not what was really going on. The recoveries, crash recoveries, were starting at the very beginning, but covertly. But what the conversation was in the 40s was kind of lights in the sky, and then in the 50s, then there were the overflights, you know, the scare over Washington, and in the 60s.
Yes, yeah, I remember that well.
In the 60s, increased focus by the Air Force on Project Blue Book, and then at the end of the 60s to attempt to get out of that with a University of Colorado study, and then there was no government program available in the 70s. So there was a beginning, however, because camera was becoming more and more available.
Yes.
And so in the 80s, now we start to get digital camera reports. In the 90s and 2000s, why we get video reports. And if you go to other countries, such as Brazil, in fact, at this conference was a good report on the Virginia case.
Yes, yes. We've done shows on that. That's an amazing thing down there.
Yeah. You find that the video cameras are now taking pictures that show up on a biweekly column done by George Filer.
Yes.
Where people, you know, ask, well, what's going on now? All you have to do is to look at Filer's biweekly report and realize that there's probably 10 reports around the world every couple of weeks with great detailed coverage of photographs and videos.
That's definitely true. You know, we do a weekly sightings report using George's website as well as other sightings, and there's never a shortage.
Yeah, yeah. The thing that... Go ahead.
No, that was just the you know, when I started doing broadcast, and you run across people that are not familiar with UFO broadcast, and I've been doing these for decades, but here in the 2000 era, let's say, in the last 5 years, people have come up to me and said, well, I'm just amazed. I always thought that happened back in the 40s and 50s, you know. And you were going to say something before I interrupted.
Well, I was going to say the thing that has impressed me as a result of my multiple years of study is the way my views have changed on this subject. Initially, there was an issue, really, and I think Jim McDonald wrestled with this issue. Was this a cover-up or a foul-up? And I've changed from the idea of believing that it might well have been a foul-up to the fact that it's the most sophisticated cover-up in the history of man, starting way back in 1941 when, you know, General Marshall and FDR covertly set up the Non-Terrestrial Research and Development Committee during the war. And so this went on at the same level as the Manhattan Project, but without the Manhattan Project's money. And then when the war was over, they got Truman to initiate the National Security Act to provide a place to hide the UFO program. And Richard Dolan, of course, talked about the four things that are being hidden today: the program, the creatures, the documents, and the money. And that's what's the thing that, in my mind, is different.
Yeah, because if you can follow the money, you could develop something, but the money's pretty well hidden in these secret programs.
Well, in the secret programs, they've got double layers of black.
Yeah, it goes on and on and on. We're talking about reverse engineering, among other things. I'm almost come to the conclusion that may be one of the bases of the whole cover-up, is there's a lot of applications here for commercial use.
Well, that's right. There were four reasons, in my judgment, for the government wanting to cover it up. First was the obvious one of preventing the technology from falling into the hands of our enemies.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is they didn't know whether it would create panic associated with religious or financial, and the third one was to stay out of jail because they were, doing illegal, unconstitutional, unethical acts in order to keep this secret. And the fourth reason is to prevent having to admit our inability to protect our airspace, to explain to the public where they're coming from, why they're here, why they're abducting people, and who's responsible for cattle mutilations, and a whole bunch of enigmatic questions that they don't know the answers to, or didn't at the time. So these are a dominant set of four reasons why you want to keep it secret.
Now we only have a couple of minutes left because you have to continue along here. We're going to have to spend a long time together sometime, and we will on the show. But in this final couple of minutes, let's talk a little bit about what is the most overpowering thing about your investigations of this subject over the years. Is it life from other planets or solar systems or galaxies, or is it what our government's doing in cooperation with somebody, or what really stands out? What interests you the most?
Well, what interests me the most is the possibility of making a direct contribution to understanding the technology that would improve life on the planet. Because I think if we begin to realize where the energy sources come from that power the UFOs, we may be able to put those into good use of finding a way to get the energy from the vacuum and make it available in the 3x3x3 foot box that was mentioned in one of the earlier papers, so that everybody can have, free power and free energy, and we get out of the problem of relying on gas.
There's so many questions. If we know and back-engineered a lot of these things and we're not using them in public, then we're really guilty of malfeasance in many ways and causing death, just, for instance, the astronauts.
Well, Jerry, I think actually the reverse engineering has been pretty effective, and I believe that there's been a process to leak that technology into the normal society, but still maintain a, say, 5 or 10 year edge militarily. So, in fact, that was what Colonel Corso claimed. I'm not sure all of his claims are accurate, but the idea of use of reverse engineering and doing it covertly is certainly valid.
Before you go, Bob, when you say I'm not sure all his claims are accurate, you're not necessarily calling anybody a liar. It's just this. There's so many layers of this stuff. You don't really know. You could be working right next to somebody.
All he specifically claimed that he was asked to find out how the parts in this particular box work. And then given that exposure, then he was asked, well, what do you think about the whole process? And then he started to speculate. Maybe the transistor was a reverse engineered device. But he was not involved in that part of it, and he never made that point clear. So.
Well, I've always felt that, all the computer information, I've never met a computer expert yet that really knows why things work. They just kind of say, hey, that's the way it is. don't ask me that. what are you doing? You got another book or a BDV or just
a couple of books in mind. One of them that Ryan and I are going to publish is an Encyclopedia of Flying Saucers. Actually, it's written by a fellow by the name of Vernon Bowen and given to the Air Force in 1955. His view of what was going on from 45 to 55. And they took it and they stamped it top secret magic. and then returned it to our source, Tim Cooper, in the year 2000. So it's sat in some government bureaucratic office all this time. But it's a great book.
I look forward to that.
You can speculate on why the pages are classified the way they are. The other book that I'm thinking of doing is one oriented towards the issue of microbiology and disease, whether or not there is some credibility on the fact that some of the people who handled the aliens, you know, in the crash recovery process may have actually been infected and died, and whether or not our government has attempted to understand those diseases in an important way, both from the point of view of using them as weapons in a bacteriological warfare sense and improving our situation to respond to and resist potential external alien transmitted diseases. That's the scope of the second book. I probably work this book with Nick Redfern.
Yeah, true. As far as subject matters, both of them are, you know, inspiring and very intriguing. I'm interested in the biological thing with the alien infections. I've often wondered about that. Just myself.
The documents do show that there are several cases where that appears to have happened.
I enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
Okay, Jerry.
That was Dr. Robert Wood, father of Ryan S. Wood, and we were at their crash retrieval conference in Las Vegas all the way back there in 2005. At that same conference, we ran across Bill Hamilton, and Bill's kind of dropped out of the UFO business, more or less. But he's always been one of my favorite researchers. It goes all the way back to KVEG in Las Vegas when Bill lived over by Palmdale and Lancaster when he used to call in. Especially he was on the Billy Goodman Show quite a lot, which followed me. And I don't guess we need to do radio history here, do we? But let's listen to this. It's a very interesting interview with Bill Hamilton, and we talk about a lot of very, very interesting subjects.
Bill Hamilton, let's tell our audience a little bit about what Project Aquarius is really all about.
Project Aquarius has been known for a while in the UFO research community. It is allegedly an umbrella named Project for all alien-related activities, the study of extraterrestrial biological entities, their history, their agenda, their involvement with us on Earth, and phases of it deal with their technology and attempts to understand their technology for the purpose of reverse engineering it. There are a lot of sub-projects under Project Aquarius. There's been many attempts to try to verify that Project Aquarius is a UFO-related project. Since there's many projects that are named Aquarius, it isn't the only Aquarius project, apparently, and this confuses people. But we do have now at least one document that's been released through the Freedom of Information Act of John Greenwald, based on Project Aquarius, that is UFO related. It's around 1982 or 83, I believe, document pertaining to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So we know that there is a UFO related Project Aquarius.
Now, in your book, do you deal with the Dan Burrish affair much?
Specifically, since Dan stated that he worked under the umbrella of Project Aquarius, and it's also written into the document that he co-authored when he was up at the Nevada test site, that we simply refer to as the Q94 document. The 94 refers to the year 1994 that it was written. Then there's -109- this kind, you know, A. This was a draft document that we have in our possession, and it concerns studies, biological studies on a cellular level of an extraterrestrial biological entity known to the research team as J-Rod.
You know, the first interview that you and I did in, back in 99 or 2000, right in that area, you came right out of the blue with this J-Rod story. I think that's about the time, I guess you'd been actually investigating Area 51 since the 70s, but when were you aware of this J-Rod?
J-Rod, I first became aware of the term J-Rod or the name J-Rod, I didn't know which, from a man that I met in 1995 by the name of Bill Uhouse. And Bill's story was, he was a retired Marine, by the way, that had gotten into the aviation field. He was a mechanical engineer, and, of course, the aviation field uses mechanical engineers and electronic engineers and aerospace engineers of all kinds because we're talking about integrated systems. And he got into the specialty of flight simulators, building flight simulators so that pilots can learn how to fly new airplanes, to control them before they get into the actual airplane and test fly them. Right? And he was recruited again by one of these secret, top secret projects to build a flight simulator for a flying saucer. So during his briefing into that particular project, which had been centered at Los Alamos National Laboratories, he was informed about a number of things, and that was that the saucer technology was a gift of our friends. Practically all of these people who work on these projects refer to these extraterrestrial visitors as our friends.
It's kind of a generic description, and everybody knows what you're talking about.
Yes. So our friends, apparently, we have not only retrieved craft that had some kind of flight systems failure, in other words, a crashed disk, like the Roswell event, but they have actually given to us as a gift some of their technology to examine. And we do not understand it fully because their physics is not our physics. And eventually, our scientists had to learn how to discard approaching the problem from the standpoint of our theories and start from scratch and do a lot of observations and what have you.
The interesting thing about that is they give it to us as a gift without the instruction book, huh?
Well, primarily, it's up to us to understand the functioning of the device through our own means so that we can relate to it. I mean, you know, we're educated in a certain way, and we have to, it's almost like doing a language translation.
Now, when you talk to Uhouse about this, and he mentioned J-Rod the first time, is that right?
Well, he said that the advisor, the scientific advisor on this project involving the simulator was, and I believe this was almost the time to break out in laughter when you heard that the boss was an extraterrestrial, right? And that not only that, that he attended a meeting at Los Alamos. Well, not Bill Uhouse, but he had heard of this meeting in which some of the scientists and one of the Majestic members was present by the name of Dr. Edward Teller and about a dozen other scientists. And J-Rod was there at the table with him wearing a long-sleeve shirt.
Mm-hmm.
See? He was maybe about, I believe, 5 feet, maybe 5 feet 2 inches tall. In other words, he He was the height of many humans, okay? However, he looked quite different. And when he spoke to you in response to some question, the question would, or the answer would be returned to you, hearing your own voice in your head.
So he doesn't physically speak. You just grasp it mentally somehow. You could hear your own voice answering.
Exactly, because even though I understand some of them make sounds, these sounds aren't directly, you know, this is like listening to a dolphin or something.
Okay.
Another thing is they have hand gestures, they communicate with gestures or sign language. But
now, for our audience, are we talking about a typical gray or a modification of that? I mean, what's the real?
Well, the J-Rod could be called a gray, yes. It is not the only variation. And this has also led to a lot of confusion. There are different variations.
Yeah, and I want to find out and pursue that a little bit later, but I'm really interested in the fact that I guess J-Rod is not the name of one single individual.
It's a category.
Yes, a race of people.
Because, again, he was making gestures indicating a symbol. And if we looked at the symbol looked like our letter J, but kind of flattened at the bottom, and beside it, a horizontal bar, okay, which you can call a rod, so shortened to J rod. It so happens that the symbols that he used seem to reproduce in an ancient language a number. And the number that it reproduces is the number 15. So J-Rod actually is a nomenclature that would be something like the word we use, 15, to denote a number. And the reason that number is used is because he came from a world 15 light years from our solar system, which was used as a staging base. It was not his origin. It was a staging base where they met with another race of beings.
And then they came to this solar system and came to Earth?
Yeah, it was, in other words, this particular planet, which has been designated in our catalog as Gliese 876c, has been known by our astronomers for some time, that the Gliese 876 system has two planets. And recently, and this is remarkable, just this year, they announced the discovery of a third planet in the Gliese 876 system, which is a rocky planet similar to the planet Earth.
Now, when the first information about J-Rod came forward from this former Marine, U-House, you probably had a little trouble assimilating it. I would, at least. This is a complicated story.
Actually, yes. And, of course, other than remarks that U-House made about engineering, and like some engineers, not like all engineers, but some engineers are their way of thinking, their graphical or even mathematical way of thinking, does not lend itself too well to articulation. So Bill was not a great articulator.
Yeah, I understand that. We had a little discussion among our staff, researchers, and producers about you, and you're an interesting fellow that you think like that. You're a scientific fellow, but I guess over the years you've learned how to articulate and communicate. So you're a little bit of both.
Well, there are scientists who speak quite well. I mean, they're clear communicators.
But many of them do not. They really kind of, it's kind of like a formula, you know.
Well, yeah. But you see, you have to understand communication itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have to understand that the purpose of communicating an idea is to convey that idea so that it is comprehended or understood by the receiving a mind that's receiving that idea, right?
So this entity that was helping us, or helping Mr. Uhouse and others,
simulate this flying saucer craft. Did he come here on his own, or was he? I've heard that stories about the Cayman crash. Is that where he came from? Or?
Well, some of the, as I understand it, the original J-Rods, there were four of them that were recovered from the Cayman crash, and I'm not too certain about this, but whether only two of them survived or all four of them survived. I do not believe they were the only ones either that had come here. My understanding now is these J-Rod's home world in our present era, okay, is Zeta Reticuli, the fourth planet of Zeta Reticuli 2. And at least this is what Bill Uhouse seemed to agree to, and this is what even mentioned by Bob Lazar, and then again by Dan Burish as something he read in what he called the King Tut books, which were briefing manuals.
Why did he call them the King Tut books?
I'm not sure,
yeah.
But they have little insider.
I mean, I have
colloquialisms that they use.
Right, right. I haven't met Dan Burish, but you have him.
Right. In other words, he doesn't talk about the underground facility at S4. He calls it the Shady Rest.
So on the look, yes, under
shady indeed. Yes, yes. See, it has a kind of a double connotation.
Sure. And so when we're talking about this, are these people have come, or these entities have come, and they've made, or have they made some sort of deal with us, or what is the situation?
Well, the situation is, it was found out that in particular the J-Rods, not particularly any other race.
Yeah, there's others evidently.
There's others. There's somebody related to the J-Rods that look more like us. Okay, they're Nordic types. And there are others beyond that who are true extraterrestrials born on foreign worlds who are coming to the Earth. However, the J-Rods and this other race, even though they are extraterrestrial in the sense of their home planet is not Earth, they originated on Earth.
Yeah, I understand that's part of the
And they come
story.
To us from our future. And this is the part that, you know, for instance, Dr. Bob Wood here is very fascinated now in the idea and the scientific studies that are going on time travel, which I've studied. And he, coming from a more grounded area of engineering and physics, on the idea that there is time travel, it seems a little startling. How could this be? This sounds like it would create too many paradoxes. However, if you study the mechanics, the space travel itself, with extremely fast velocities, interstellar travel, that space travel and time travel go together, hand in hand. And this simply falls out of the time dilation equations in the theory of relativity, which says that the time itself, like if you have a second of time here that's passing on Earth, mm-hmm. and you have a spacecraft taking off from Earth going to nearby Alpha Centauri, okay, and it reaches velocities, let's say 95% of what we measure as the speed of light, okay, that a second takes much longer to tick, okay, when we see this. So that instead of, you know, like Alpha Centauri is about 4.3 light years mm-hmm. distant. Well, instead of taking at that velocity 4.5 years, let's say, to reach Alpha Centauri, they may reach there in less than a year. So the idea is if there are twins, and this is called the twin paradox, that there are twins, and one of the twins works in the Houston Space Center, and the other twin is the astronaut that goes to Alpha Centauri, and he goes there and he turns around and he comes back.
The first twin that stayed here is much older.
Exactly. He is older because for him, now there's been an elapsed time of, well, it took the guy, you know, according to his measurements, of 4.5 years to get there, 4.5 years to get back. Well, that's 9 years. Let's say the astronaut experience was about a year to get there and a year to come back. So only 2 years has passed. He's only 2 years older because of biology has its own clock and will also slow its rate.
Right, it sounds very complicated, but on the other hand, it's fairly simple. If you're in this capsule moving someplace near the speed of light or whatever, time has slowed down, elongated itself.
But in practical reality, if this really happened, of course we haven't proven it because we haven't done it. But if the astronaut came back 9 years later, and for him only 2 years has passed, he's effectively traveled to the future.
Yes,
he skipped ahead.
Well, that brings me up to this book that Dan Burrish wrote back there with B.J. Wolf and a third party who I don't know.
Right.
It was basically going to Mars, I believe, and seeing something there, 2020 AD. Is that right?
Well, he saw structures that now exist on Mars.
Uh-huh.
Okay. The paradox.
I mean, is this a fiction book or?
No. This is a real study that Dan did.
Okay.
He did it prompted by communications he had with the J-Rod.
Okay.
Communications in which the J-Rod could show him images. The only way that I could simulate what these images were like is not just images in your mind, okay, but as if this room was turned into a holodeck, right, like on Star Trek.
Yes.
Okay. Then you have scenes running like a virtual reality. You can actually reach out and touch things, interact with holodeck images. It's supposed to be a hologram, right? Well, in the same way, J-Rod had this tremendous advanced mental facility to place Dan inside a virtual reality.
He could do it without the...
Without the mechanism.
Yes, okay.
Simply by mind power. And he showed him these images of Mars, and this is why he pursued the research.
And there seems to be some reason why we haven't really gone to certain places on Mars, and maybe we know more than we're supposed to know, huh? What's the deal? What's your feeling about it?
Well, this is speculation.
Yeah, I understand.
There's a lot of talk about it, but I have been in contact with another person who has inside knowledge who once worked for NASA.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an engineer by training, but also very, very interested in the UFO subject. And... He tells me that NASA is, there are compartments like anywhere else within NASA who have, and he was in one of these compartments who had advanced clearances for advanced space missions where they sent out probes to the edge of the solar system that are not known by the public.
Hmm.
And these probes, furthermore, were sent out by, under the aegis of the National Security agency, and one begins to wonder what interest does an intelligence gathering agency have in sending probes beyond Saturn, right? Unless, and what could they possibly listen to in the form of electronic messages out around Saturn that would make any sense to them? Well, according to him, NASA is well aware that there are over 160 civilizations out there that have made some form of contact with us over time.
160.
Yeah, probably about 165 or 160. Well, an engineer I talked to said 167. The two numbers are so close that I would add. There have been other numbers coming out from other people that are much lower than this, but these two came into a very close agreement.
That's a lot of different species contacting us. They seem to be all in unison. They all are doing it in secret, at least.
Yeah, and again, I have to make the statement that there is no present way that I can authenticate information like that. So what I do is I correlate the information from independent sources to see if some of the information agrees. And when it does, this raises the possibility that the information may be authentic.
A couple of things that I think of immediately, Bill, is first of all, how did you come across the Dan Burrish story? I guess you met BJ or something?
Well, what happened was she had posted that she had a document on the Internet. This was back in 1999, and she had excerpts from this particular document we call the Q94, and I was looking at it, and one of the things that I read in the document was that it was a it involved the extraction of tissue samples from an extraterrestrial biological entity designated AQ-J-Rod. So I saw the J rod there. I didn't know what the AQ was, but the AQ was for Aquarius.
Okay.
And this was authored by, at the bottom, there were two names on it. One name was principal investigator was Dr. Danny B. Crane, Captain USN. And it was a draft. But when I noticed the J rod, I said, wait a minute. J rod. That's what Bill Uhouse talked about. And I selected this out simply for the reason that if one person mentioned J-Rod and a second person mentioned J-Rod, could I find more people who had some kind of inside work that would verify the existence of J-Rod? Well, now I have
eight people.
So that's pretty strong. None of them have denied the existence of at least one J-Rod. So this is what attracted me to it. And the other part of it was this paper seemed to be highly technical in its content, and that attracted me because I've never seen a technical paper. Usually it's a report. If you look at the Majestic documents, you see reports. You know, progress report.
Yes,
and what have you? There's some scientific data in there, but not much. Well, this was a scientific report, and it was done in a certain form, a briefing form, and it was a draft copy of it. And so I got hold of her, and I sent for because the original leak was photocopied in reverse. And you could not easily read it. I sent away for that, and it's a translation so that you could, you know,
yes,
it was readable. And it also had the logo of the Naval Space Command on it.
Now, we know her real name now. That's a pen name, right?
Right. Her real name is Marcia McDowell.
And You've known her since 99, I guess.
Well, only by email. And it wasn't until 2002 when I tried to get more responses from her, but it seemed like she was unwilling and reluctant to make contact with UFO researchers until she was at a point where...
Makes you wonder why that one thing was on the forum.
She was trying to get some attention because she felt that Dan was being abused.
Well, we will probably get into that because there's been a lot of people that, you know, I just mentioned the name Dan Burrish, and I get 8, 9, 10 emails saying, hey, what are you talking about him for?
Right.
I've never really seen as much people questioning things, just like... How did they get into challenging his degree at SUNY, for instance? I mean,
the same way that Bob Lazar, claimed that he had a master's degree in physics, and the only verification of any degree that Bob Lazar has is an AA degree from Pierce College, where I went too, by the way. So there's no proof, in other words, that Lazar has an engineering or science degree of any kind. You cannot verify it. Well, he's not the only one. I met a guy named Dan Woolman. You can prove he's an engineer, but you can't prove he's a physicist because his advanced degree is not acknowledged by the university either. Dan Burish's degree is not acknowledged by State University in New York either. And I checked out. I have a lot of documents on the Dan Burish case, and I wrote to SUNY, and no, we don't have... we don't have on record a student by that name or an individual by that name. However, I came to find out, because I worked at UCLA, that a student who doesn't want public access to his records, a student can sign a form, a privacy form, a barring access to verification that he went to a certain university. Now, if a student can do this by law, what about an intelligence agency? What if a CIA agent was sent to school and the CIA doesn't want anybody to know that this person went to the school?
Right? I have, and you know more about that since you work for a major university. I've often wondered, I've been told before, police agencies and federal agencies, investigating agencies, FBI, et cetera, they can probably go get the information, but it's pretty tough on other people if they don't want you to know it. In other words, if the student signs a statement, nobody can find anything out.
So, actually, what I've had to settle for are notarized statements.
And you have some, and you have some interesting documents.
Which state that people know that he had received a degree because they had seen that early on.
What's his reaction when you ask him things like that? Did you really get a... Because a lot of people are saying, hey, this was just a corrections officer.
Well, I'll tell you how serious he is about it.
Okay.
The reason, the book I told you about, Mars,
yes. Uh-huh.
That's when they yanked any verification of his degree. Majestic did that. I mean, they just... they paid for his education there in the first place anyway.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Unknown to his mother, he did go there for 9 particular workshop sessions. But it was highly unorthodox that they were, and they were paid, 3 professors, and I have their names, were paid to come out here and give him oral exams. And he's an extremely bright man. He has a second degree, by the way, now, in biological systems, PhD. Okay. He's not exposing that, and he doesn't want that record erased right now. But there's a way through a back door that I don't want to discuss in any detail toward verifying that he indeed had a PhD from SUNY, and the way we're going about that is in secret right now, but he is willing to even go forward and file a lawsuit if necessary to get attention. Now, whether Majestic will say, send down a communication to him and say, well, Dan, you don't have to go that far.
Okay, so
there are ways, in other words,
right,
that we're attempting, and he is willing to go so far as to file a lawsuit if necessary, at which time, I guess, he does found ways of applying pressure on the overseers, so to speak, sometimes to get his way, right, to get something he wants.
Now, you guys met with him recently, and you've done a video interview with him at one time that some people have seen.
Right.
And what kind of guy is he?
Dan is just a regular guy. I mean, he is a guy who's got a good sense of humor, quick wit, and almost eidetic memory, can rattle off... scientific and technical terms quicker than you can say, wait, hold it, I need a dictionary, right? I have seen him perform tasks on microscope. He's an expert in microscopic work. He was one of the youngest members of the Los Angeles Microscopical Society.
He has a degree from UNLV, too, right?
Yes, he has a degree from UNLV.
And did he get his master's there?
No. No, he just recently got transcripts about his master's, which was at a seminary, believe it or not.
Okay, that explains an email I ran across where he's a Doctor of Divinity, maybe.
I think he just got an M.A.
Okay.
From a seminary, because at one time he wanted to be a Catholic priest because he experienced what we would call like kind of a miracle healing from a Catholic priest.
Now, what did he have wrong with him, or do you know, or is it even important? I'm just kind of sure.
He was a teacher, something like that.
Okay.
I'm not sure exactly what, but he was going blind and what have you, and that would be an extremely impairing, ability to have. Right, especially if you're looking through a microscope.
Yeah, yes, if your work deals with that.
But he has no problem with his vision today.
Now, it's interesting that he was interested in the Catholic religion, correct?
Yes, because it was his mother brought him to a Catholic priest.
And now we talk about this key to life that he has now. It's called the Garnish or Ganesh?
Ganesh particle, the Lotus Project.
Yes, and that really, that name, I believe, comes from a Hindu religion.
Exactly. He extracted these particles initially at ancient bedrock up here at Frenchman Mountain. Okay, there's what's called the Great Unconformity. And the bedrock is 700 million years old, which goes back to about the Precambrian era, okay? And extracting these particles from there, from Vishnu schist, what is called Vishnu schist. Well, the word Vishnu suggested to him that he should, to identify something brand new that he was seeing under the microscope, he started using terms from Hindu mythology. Okay, so Ganesh particle is one of them. There's also the pearls of Brahma, okay, that he has seen under microscope. One thing where he departed from this is an object that he terms the Selkie, after Greek mythology, okay? But the whole thing, and I have seen...
Now he goes up there quite often to this area we were just talking about.
Yes.
He kind of gets renewed there, and he's found a... something very interesting. We talked to you about the Phoenix Lights, and there's this glaze that on some mountains down there too, coating or something. Are we talking about portals or something, you think?
But yeah, he sees what we could term micro portals. At least that's what we think they are.
Yeah.
You could see them on the video. There's a flashlight when they open up, and then there's the emergence of this concatenation of particles. Okay, and when the Ganesh particle comes out, when he's doing a testing of this, he will place a test sample, like an injured or damaged cell, close to the portal. And when the Ganesh particle comes out, led by the Selkie, it determines exactly where the injured area in the cell is. And then it builds a cross bridge into that area, and... presto, like magic, the cell is repaired.
Now, he came across this when through J-Rod.
Yes.
The basic research came from there.
Well, yeah. Initially, he called it Mission Genesis. Okay. How did life start on Earth?
Now, let's talk a little bit about, if we can, Marcia. There seems to be a lot of religious significance in some of these writings. And was she like Dan, going to be something in the religious field originally?
No, she has a different perspective. Comes from a different background on it.
I was reading her.
Dan's migrated more into mysticism.
Yes.
more than anything else.
And it doesn't seem like Marcy's followed him on that, or maybe she has by now.
Well, yeah, they're both interested, for instance, in the subject of sacred geometry, because what they're seeing, and if you look at these video images, you could see outlines of platonic solids appearing, like the icosahedron or dodecahedrons, and especially the octahedrons. And octahedral crystals are stimulated by a certain electrical voltage, and this is what apparently, it's kind of a hit-and-miss thing right now, but this is what produces, encourages the micro-portals to open up. And I've been doing some speculation from the physics side of it, and introduced the research going on with biophotons to Dan, and he has now incorporated that into the LOTUS project, the biophotons.
Well, in other words, you and Dan Burrish have a good relationship. You can even suggest
right.
things along.
But see, I want to explore this with some instruments myself while it's taking place, and he's a little bit leery of having me do that at the present time, simply because there are certain tones involved, okay? And these tones, and I've seen only images on this, but I've talked to the witnesses, certain combinations of tones can be extremely destructive as well as constructive, okay? You get the wrong combination, and it can be so destructive that if the military mind sees this, they're going to say, look at this. We want all of your records on this. We want to see what's doing this. We want to see if we can reproduce this, because this would be an excellent weapon.
So
he won't let that happen.
Yeah, I started to say, it seems to me that he's in the government, paid his way to SUNY. I guess they sent him to Area 51 after that, or what? I mean, how did that happen?
Well, he was up at the TTR originally, okay, and then to Area 51, Groom Lake, for a while, and then over to the Papoose Mountain facility, R4800. So, and he spent time down there. Now very few people have access to the level he had access. It's very controlled. And, I mean, it's like this. Okay, here's two red lines. Here's a blue line. You walk along that blue line. You don't stray over the red line. You stray over the red line, and you go to the cemetery. That's your next stop.
Yeah.
Okay, because they have Navy SEALs. Ryan O'Connor, or Connor, whatever his name was, Connor, was one of the SEALs that talked to Wendell Stevens.
Yes.
Was also at SEAL.
Uh-huh.
You probably are familiar with that story. But definitely, SEALs are the Navy. Okay, the Navy is in control of these projects there. And they've gained more and more control because they're one of the oldest services. They have seniority, Naval Space Command, Naval Research Labs. You'll see Naval Intelligence.
Navy Intelligence was right off the bat. They got interested.
And then there's this Department of Naval Intelligence, which you can't find whether it exists or not, because the regular Naval Intelligence is called the ONI, Office of Naval Intelligence. See, so this is like a shadow.
Did Dan ever tell you the first time that he came up on J-Rod at Area 51? I mean,
well, they didn't tell him about it. They simply had him doing microscopic work and looking at cellular or tissue samples, okay? And they had an automatic system. They had, you know, there's like a conveyor belt, okay? And they can't reach out and touch the samples. The sample passes to their station. They have a keyboard, and the keyboard controls the lenses, okay? Well, he got very frustrated with that type of work after 6 months because they wouldn't answer certain questions. Where did these samples come from? I've never seen cells that look like this. And he was trained in cellular biology, right? And he's seen a kind of cellular metabolism that's taking place that includes a chemistry that's not common to any life on Earth. So that's why he was pressing, where did you get these cells from, right? And after a while, they just let him go. In other words, well, you know, go take R&R, you know. And then they brought him back. And when they brought them back, that's when they said, sit in this room, very similar to Bob Lazar, you know, and read these books. Well, there were books on everything. Well, propulsion, he's not interested in that, right? Yeah. He just stuck to the biology, right? So, and that's where he learned, here's the origin of this entity was Zeta Reticuli 2,
yeah.
Right, planet 4. But it wasn't until later that he found out, yeah, Zeta Reticuli 52,000 years from now. And that was a startling revelation.
Okay. Well, it would be.
Yeah. That this being here had traveled back in time because his people originally came from Earth.
Now the theory here that we're talking about is these people came back to Earth now. Why? Because there's going to be a major event happening?
Because the catastrophic event that happened split the human genome and divided the... And what happened is that it created the time loop also. The process of time travel, convergent time travel, creates a loop. And it overlays a timeline with another timeline. In other words, it's a modification that's... You would have to understand what happens in the realm of quantum mechanics and the collapse of the wave function. When there's a collapse of the wave function, probability that manifests itself is a new probability. And that probability replaces the reality that was there for the new reality. Okay. Now, what they've been trying to do is fix it.
So they still exist. Is that right?
Yeah, so that
I mean,
well, they're trying to fix it so that the split doesn't occur. The genomic split doesn't occur.
And then what would happen to them? I mean, it looks like they would change.
They would remain as they are. They would remain as they are. We would remain as we are. And a greater portion of humanity would survive. And for a greater portion of humanity to survive, we have had to have the help of actual other extraterrestrial civilizations that have the technology to minimize the destruction that's coming from our sun.
And the way I understand it, probably what we're talking about here, over 35,000 years or so, the magnetic pole shifts,
precession of the equinox,
yeah, and basically, we don't have protection from the solar flares.
Well, see, apparently there are.
I'm trying to get it into where all of us can understand.
Yeah, well, there are cycles. Okay, a study that I've been doing. In fact, I'm going to be going on another radio show simply about the cycles of time. And there are minor cycles and major cycles and grand cycles. Right. My estimation is we're coming up on a confluence of minor and major cycles, so that the threat zone or the threat level is much greater than it was, let's say, during the last catastrophic period of about 11,500 years ago, roughly.
So are we talking about the time period where Homo sapiens went to Homo sapiens sapiens, or?
No.
Okay, this is later.
This is more recent history.
Okay.
This is the time period of the destruction of the legendary Atlantis, you know, that kind of period of time when something catastrophic happened to the Earth. We're talking about the possibility of a magnetic pole shift. And I have found at least one professor who says that the magnetic shift can take place as rapidly as he's found evidence of a 30-day period when the polarity shifted in Oregon, in the iron mountains of Oregon, right?
Well, if it could
happen that rapidly, just the magnetic shift alone is somewhat catastrophic. But what we're seeing now is a change in the thermalicity of the sun. A change in the planets of the solar system. They're all undergoing global warming. We're seeing a change in the Earth where the internal heat-producing factory of the Earth is bubbling to the surface, and we're seeing the melting of the Arctic ice cap. We're seeing the disintegration of the Antarctic ice cap. We're going to see not only does the ocean water heat up from this source of heat, but it expands in volume. And if it expands in volume, then low-lying areas, let's say the state of Florida, for instance, which is all very low-lying, and could be inundated, could be totally inundated by the ocean within years. And now there are scientists who are seriously disturbed by what they see is happening. And, of course, the thermal gradients in the ocean are such that it's feeding these hurricanes. It's fueling them up, and that's why we're seeing these Category 5s. And, of course, tonight on television, they're going to show this science fiction scenario called Category 7, the end of the world, right?
You spoke about television. CBS has a new series on Friday nights. I forget the name of it, but it's very similar to the whole Dan Burrish affair, right? Yes.
Yeah.
It's very similar to a lot of the things we're talking about.
Threshold, and there's one called Invasion on Wednesday nights. That's very, very good. There's an outbreak of these kind of programs right now that are very interesting, and I have been informed of certain other programs that are in the works that are being guided, so to speak, toward...
We haven't really gotten into this part of it, but, I mean, your theory is, and we'll continue this conversation at another time, but your theory is that there's what, or maybe you believe it?
Well, it's not my theory. It's that there are certain claims being made that we're not undergoing changes. We know we're undergoing climate changes that some scientists think are... changes that will accumulate over a half a century to a century.
But
what I'm talking about is a catastrophic change that takes place all at once.
But, I mean, if J-Rod came from the future, then he told Dan or somebody
exactly
what's happened.
Well, yeah, it wasn't just Dan.
And it's more natural than man-made?
Natural, yes.
And
it's a natural consequence of the journey of our solar system through the galaxy. 250 million years ago, okay, which is one grand year, one circuit around the galaxy for our sun and family of planets, there was a major extinction event on the Earth, or what they call an ELE, okay, an extinction-level event, whereby at least 90% of ocean life and 75% of land life was extinguished. What caused it? Okay, and that's the search is on now. There is a desperate search going on as to whether we are going to experience another ELE or not, and what's causing it. And you don't want to panic the public while you're doing your research, right? But more and more people are becoming aware.
Well, I think the public is beginning to accept, especially of just this summer season and the tsunami last year and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that there's some natural changes going on.
Look at that tremendous underwater quake in Sumatra, and the fact that nearby is a super volcano, and we have one right here in the States, in Yellowstone. And there was a documentary on what would happen if the Yellowstone super volcano were to erupt. Well, you could say shut the doors on the United States commerce and everyday life and the economy and everything else because of the devastation.
Yeah, so... What is a Majestic 12, and then there's another group, I'll call them the Illuminati for the international part. That's probably not the same Illuminati we've talked about.
No, but that's a good name as any. Let's just say there are factions.
Yeah.
There are multiple factions.
I mean, why wouldn't they want people to be aware of this? I mean, there's a lot of great deal of money to be made.
You could save a lot of people, but you can't save all of the people. Unless they got a new plan. I mean, they do have underground shelters, deep underground shelters. They could shelter people for... and there's people already living, as I understand it, in these underground cities that have been constructed to provide them with all the amenities of life for a period of time, at least a period of time that will get them through the catastrophic period.
How many people, and this would be a corporate or a government or a United Nations?
I would say both.
How many people know about this, you think?
Enough people that I can get information on it, but not all. Everyone knows about it. We know about underground facilities that are used for various purposes, research, materials, military, whatever, you know, like Cheyenne Mountain is just an insane.
I can't let you go without asking you, and there's so many other things we'll do in future shows about this, but when Dan saw J-Rod the first time, did he ever see him face-to-face?
Oh, well, yeah, but he was suited up. He was in encapsulated.
Right, because J-Rod had, another type of atmosphere?
Because the atmosphere that he was then breathing supported a metabolism that would not support human metabolism. It would be toxic to us.
But he would...
His metabolism...
He would survive in that. In other words, the J-Rod types that are...
They weren't always like that. They changed.
They just kind of changed to adapt to wherever they went.
Right. Even the ones from half that distance in time were okay and could have walked. For instance, the one Bill Uhouse saw was perfectly comfortable.
Yeah, he was setting an office in Los Alamos.
Exactly.
Wonder how he got there.
But he did not come from the as far in the future as the J-Rod that... that Dan had was examining, because 7,000 years, in fact, separates the two J-Rods. And at that point, a deterioration started in. And they will go extinct unless they correct whatever the genetic factors are that can be corrected.
And it might be...
And you would wonder, well, how come they can't correct them themselves, right?
Yeah.
Well, they needed us. They needed us when the genome was still intact.
And so that explains all of the activity back here at this point. Or
exactly.
Most of it.
Exactly, and explains abductions on those J-Rods that were not part of the Republic, who wanted to continue their own agenda.
And there's more than one agenda with them.
And more than one agenda with them. And then we have other races with other agendas. They have nothing whatsoever to do with that. Except if they are part of the treaty process, they're here to assist in the solutions. This sounds all like science fiction. And
it's a great miniseries.
Yeah, and as far as we know, we're going beyond anything we can verify. But you're asking me, what are they saying? This is what they're saying.
Yeah, that's basically what I wanted to get at.
And prior to that, like the latest thing coming out is the Alien Exchange Program. Well, I've known about that for some years, but now some people are leaking out details that we sent 12 people to their planet. They sent aliens here to help us out. We sent them there to get an education. They stayed there. I think it was 20 years, and 8 of the 12 came back.
The other 4 didn't want to, or they didn't live?
They didn't live, for some reason or another. Yeah, it could be accident, natural causes, whatever.
And so in closing here, you talked to Dan Burrish. He's given you interviews. Is he going to give other people interviews later, you think?
When he is done with this debriefing process, which he's estimating in another 4 months, he'll open the door to the interview.
Because it seems to be that he's kind of responsible in many ways of people taking pot shots at him because he's not available. You know what I mean?
Well, right now it's lucky it's just pot shots. Mm-hmm. When it turns into real shots and he has to duck and cover, then he can become concerned.
I
just may do come to that.
Well, that is the first inclination I had about it.
There's going to be people that don't like what he has to say.
The first question our staff beat around when this first came out a couple of years ago was, why is this guy still alive?
Well, of course.
Why is he?
I mean, one time, you know, he was, you might say, physically mistreated, like a warning, you know, get into line. But because he has been endeared to one of the overseers, I'll call him, he's gotten off the hook. And now they're seeing that he indeed has the facility of getting the public's attention, and they're going to use them in that way. But again, like I said, there's different factions who want to get out the story. They all have their own, you might say, scenarios to report, and their own spin, because they want to control the spin. They want to control what the public is going to believe. But in the long run, it's the big guys that are going to have the last say-so.
In summary here, what do you think is going to happen in 2006 after he does all his research? Will people believe him, or will he be completely discounted?
We're going to wait and see. What I'm seeing now is more and more people will come forward, and people have come forward in the past to support him. I have heard privately from other individuals who said they also work for Majestic, and they know Dan, and they know he is has worked for them, and they will support him. If necessary, they will testify in a court of law. And Dan himself has signed a notarized statement to the effect that he has been involved with Majestic, that he has witnessed the J-Rod, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's already been submitted to a court of law in Canada, and he's willing to have it submitted to a court of law here in the United States, and call your witnesses, and he'll have witnesses called who will testify on his behalf. So even the skeptics among other insiders who work for the DIA or other agencies who do not believe Dan because they don't have a record of him, they don't have access to what he had access to, could also be challenged when he comes forward and still stands by his word. And nobody will ever find a shred of proof that there was some kind of a hoax or fraud involved, because there isn't. And as you've seen, there's many witnesses. Even his mother and father support his story.
Yes. And, you know, we're going to continue with more shows on this subject, Bill. It's been a fascinating hour or so. And
okay.
We'll be looking forward to the book, Project Aquarius. And
yes.
I know you're on top of the story, and we'll stay in touch.
Okay, Jerry.
Okay, thank you very much.
This is a recording from October 7th, 1965. The light, unidentified flying craft were near Edwards Air Force Base. That's up there in Palmdale, Lancaster, California, in the high desert of California, in Southern California. Now, here's part of a phone call to the base commander about the UFO sightings from an unnamed Air Force personnel.
We have everybody around has had radar and visual objects on them, and they're flashing lights that have been running in the vicinity of 4 to 12,000 feet from various observations.
That was an unidentified, probably an officer of the Air Force. He called the base commander at Air Force Base. The date on this again was in October of 1965, and he was talking about lights around Air Force, the Air Force Base, unidentified flying objects, in other words, and they were being painted on radar, as you heard as well. Now, in addition to that, I have a recording made the same night of the air controllers from three different sites in Southern California. That would be at Edwards Air Force Base, and I also believe Victorville. And we are going to play this for you right now. This is the actual tape from the control from the Air Force, I believe. Oh, this might be the commercial tape, but anyway, you can hear the Edwards Air Force Base controller on this tape as they later order a pilot to check out the UFOs over the desert.
You flew fast. Did you scramble on this or what?
Yes.
120,000 feet. So low. It looks like it's right above him from the tower now. It looks almost directly above him and rising.
And, of course, as you heard that, the air controller said low. As the pilot spotted him, he was low to the desert floor at Boron, California. And he went up about 40,000 feet and,
recall the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, there was a sequence in there where flight controllers were working with aircraft, and they were stating that they were seeing UFOs over Ohio, and it has a very similar feel to it, but obviously it's two different things. One is fiction and one is definitely fact.
This is Jerry Pippin, and this has been our UFO show for this week. Thanks for listening. Until next time, cheers. Mm-hmm.